We are going to open and close today's program with an acknowledgement of some impressive things happening in Williamston. First of all, congratulations to Williamston's boys basketball team off to the Breslin Center here for the Class B state semifinal after an impressive win over River Rouge yesterday. And later in the hour, we actually go to Williamston on an academic journey here. Students out there have been working on a science project that's part of a Lemelson MIT grant, and what they've put together is pretty impressive. They make it available, viewable to the public tonight, and Kevin Lavery files a report on that later in the hour. Pretty impressive stuff out in Williamston. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. At the top of our program, Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero delivered his 11th State of the City address last night. The speech was entitled Accelerate Lansing, and it was held at the NioWave radioisotope production facility near the Capital Region International Airport. The speech was a follow-up to the State of the City report issued to the City Council in January. Bernero's remarks touched on topics like the idea of selling City Hall, an expected surplus in the coming fiscal year, and a new sister city relationship with Flint. Joining us to analyze Mayor Bernero's remarks and the reaction to them, Lansing State Journal reporter Eric Lacey. Welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me on. I'm amped to be here.
All right. Well, we're amped to have you. Before we get to the initiatives and priorities in the address, at least a couple of members of the City Council, Carol Wood and Jody Washington, at least, skipped the speech. Apparently because of the venue, NioWave. Can you explain what's going on there?
Yeah, if some people remember, in the Walnut neighborhood of Lansing, kind of right near, right off of Oakland there, near Old Town, NioWave has their headquarters, and a lot of folks in the neighborhood over there. Part of the reason why I know this is because for a while I lived over there when I came back to Lansing about a year ago. They were really upset with NioWave because they built their headquarters at the old school over there. I think it's Walnut School. And, what they did was they built an addition, and a lot of the folks in the neighborhood say it looks like a pole barn, and the addition still looks the way it does. And NioWave received some tax credits, and part of the deal from during my reporting, I found this out, and a lot of other folks did too. They were supposed to fix the facade, and to this point, they never have. And so a lot of the council members, like the ones you mentioned, were really upset with the city about those tax breaks for NioWave, and NioWave still got the tax breaks, yet, like I said, they didn't fix the facade, and so the fact that the State of the City was at the other NioWave headquarters, I know, upset some, especially Carol Wood. I reached out to her about that. So that's where that is, and it doesn't look like NioWave will get those tax credits rescinded because it was a state, it got up to the State Tax Commission, and, you know, we move on, apparently. There's not a whole lot that can happen now, I don't believe.
Council member Jessica Yorko attended the speech last night, but afterwards she posted to her Facebook page a note defending the T-shirt that she wore to the event. It said, NioWave lies, exclamation point, fix the facade, exclamation point. Is there any indication that the mayor knew that he would face resistance for holding the address at NioWave? Do you know anything about that?
You know, to my knowledge, he's a pretty clever guy, so I would have to imagine that he knew that there were some people that would be upset about it. But I will say that, and I did reach out to Jessica on Facebook afterward, and, you know, she did tell me that she had some folks that say, asking her, you know, wondering why she was wearing the shirt. I will say that there were a couple other people from the Walnut neighborhood that wore a couple of shirts as well that were in the crowd, but they didn't cause any disturbances or anything like that. So, I would have to believe that Virge must have known. I know for a while there, Jessica, from what I saw, had a jacket on, so it wasn't like she had that shirt just in plain view during the whole speech.
Understood. So, yeah. You led your coverage with news of a new position that Mayor Bernero wants for the city, Housing Ombudsman, which sounds very important, and word of a new program that is apparently related to that, the Block-to-Block Program, or B3. What's that all about?
Well, a lot of the details, I think, still need to be worked out, but Mayor Bernero said that he wanted to create that program, the B3, to try to cater to different neighborhoods throughout the city. I think that, to be honest with you, that's easier said than done. I think all need to know more details about that. And with the housing ombudsman, from what I can tell, it would be a position that would kind of be a liaison with the Greater Lansing Housing Commission. And from what I gathered last night, maybe deal with like landlord-tenant issues and things like that. Based on my experience, I can tell you that I lived in a rental home in Lansing last year when I first got back to Lansing, my wife and my newborn daughter and I can tell you in the neighborhood I was in that Walnut neighborhood, for example, there's a lot of different kinds of homes. There's a lot of older housing stock there. And I think it's my hope, being a Lansing native and the hope of others, that something like a housing ombudsman will look into those issues and look into details with how landlords do their business and things like that. But that being said, you know, he's going to present his budget next week, and we should know more then, hopefully. And then ultimately, it's up to the council to decide what they want to do. I want to remind folks that it was last year when Bernero proposed an inspector general for the BWL,
right?
And we know that never happened. So I would say don't get your hopes up, but at the same time, I think it's an interesting position that could do a lot of good.
Well, it seems to be some kind of outreach to the neighborhoods, and it signals making the neighborhoods a priority, and we can assume that there will be that will be an item in the budget with a dollar amount attached to it. Eric Lacey covers the Lansing City Hall for the Lansing State Journal. We're discussing last night's State of the City address by Mayor Virg Bernero. The idea of selling City Hall was raised again. He explained that the current City Hall would be put on the market and city operations would move into the former Lake Trust Credit Union headquarters building on South Capitol. Here he is.
We would sell the existing City Hall site, a very marketable location, with vast potential for reuse, located directly across from the state capitol. It's one of the most desirable parcels in the city. The proceeds from the sale of the old City Hall can be put toward the construction cost of the new City Hall.
Tell us more about this proposal. This idea has been, one variation or another of this idea has been in circulation for a while. Does the idea have traction with the city council?
Well, I think it depends on who you talk to. I know for a lot of city employees, I think they'd be all for it. I think for a lot of mayoral appointees, like department heads, they'd be all for it because they spend the most time in the building. I can tell you, of all the council members, I think Carol Wood probably spends the most time in the building because she goes full force, you know, treats it like a full-time job. Not to discount what the other council members do, but you know, when I call, she's in that office all the time. So I think maybe she would be more passionate one way or the other about moving City Hall. But for the other folks, I can tell you, like, some of the department heads, they work 9 to 5 in there. They've told me they got to take an elevator up and sometimes be next to somebody in shackles that's going up to the court over there, 54A. I mean, it's a weird, logistically, it's really weird how that building is kind of laid out. And the fact, you know, there's one metal detector, there's one entrance. You could have the mayor walking in at the same time somebody's about to get sentenced in the court. It's kind of strange. It's weird. You know, I can vouch for the fact that I've seen cockroaches in the bathroom up there and things like that. It's an old place, and if they could move out of there, I think it'd be a good deal. But I think ultimately, you know, where's the money going to come from? How are you going to sell the current City Hall? I know they tried to sell it before. To, I think, the state Senate for their offices, and that didn't work out. But like Verge said last night, he thinks that, you know, to maintain the current City Hall would take maybe $50 to $60 million, and that for about half the cost, they could move to Lake Trust. So we'll see. You know, on the other side of things, too, he talked about regionalism. So, you know, I think at some point, I think anybody who's associated with 54A court would want to get out of there too, get out of that whole complex. Because when I covered the lawsuit trial for former council member Aileen Bowles last week, the judge who came in from Livingston County was publicly complaining about the setup in that whole building, wondering about internet access, wondering about, is this the only way in this place or what?
How about that?
You know, there you go. So there's a lot of issues. And again, one of those things which sounds great, you know, in a speech, But at the same time, more will be revealed and more needs to get done for that to happen.
Bernero also touched on Lansing's relationship with Flint. The Board of Water and Light has begun helping Flint remove lead water lines. Last night, Flint Mayor Karen Weaver and other officials joined Bernero in signing an agreement making Flint and Lansing sister cities.
This agreement formalizes a new partnership that will involve a number of organizations and individuals, including those in education, business, healthcare, the arts, and other endeavors.
What do we know about this arrangement? What does it mean exactly, Eric?
Well, what we do know is Mayor Bernero said last night that with this sister cities agreement, this would be the first city in Michigan to be a sister city to Lansing, technically on paper, and that
we've got sister cities around the world, but
right,
we don't have any in Michigan.
Right, I think we have one in Japan.
Yeah.
But what he did mention is that some organizations and groups, maybe in the fields of education, the arts, things like that, could share resources, maybe put together some initiatives. So, again, something that sounds great, but is this just politics and just timeliness, at hand here because of the Flint water crisis, because of things like that, or is this something that's really going to bring about real action? Again, we'll have to wait and see.
Mayor Bernero strongly supported the plan to build a new Board of Water and Light substation on the north edge of Riotown on the site where the historic Scott's House now stands. Let's listen to those remarks.
Building this substation is vital to decommissioning the coal-fired Eckert Power Plant. It must be built, and the selected site at the entrance to Riotown is the optimal location. It is the place. I fully support moving the house at Scott Park to a different location and allowing qualified private investors to renovate it if they wish.
Now, the site, though, has faced opposition from those who would preserve the Scott House where it is. How do you think this might play out? How much opposition is there to this?
That's a great question. And honestly, I really don't know. You know, I don't know. And as far as the process of moving the house, you know, how much is it used? I know there's that women's museum over there, which is a great asset, but how many people go to that women's museum over in that area too, off 496? And again, not to disparage the women's museum, but you know, I've seen renderings of the substation. I know there's plenty of people out there that like it. And the fact is that I think the bigger issue is Eckert's going to have to go offline in about 5 years. I've actually got the pleasure of touring inside the Eckert plant, coal-fired plant. You know, and they need to find options. And, you know, I think it's part of a bigger piece of BWL and the city's power plan in trying to prepare to put Eckert offline. So, you know, for a lot of folks, I can understand that they appreciate their history, and I respect that. But at the same time, I think a lot of folks wouldn't want to see their rates going up either if BWL and the city don't provide any other options out there, and then we just kind of wing it for the next 5 years with Eckert. Knowing we don't know what the political climate's going to be, we don't know what EPA standards are going to be like down the road. And who knows? We could have a president that wants to shut down the EPA for all we know.
We have less than a minute, but I do want to ask you about the severance arrangement involving ex-city attorney Janine McIntyre. You reported on this earlier in the week.
Yeah.
We had Jody Washington on our program yesterday at this time expressing all kinds of doubts about this. Tell us what you know about that briefly here, if you could, and where do you think this might be going?
Yeah, Mayor Bernero and the city attorney, Janine McIntyre, the former city attorney, signed a legal agreement. I don't anticipate any real details coming out about what happened. Why did she get the over $160,000? At the same time, city council is, I think, at least most of them are going to try as hard as they can to try to get answers. Even Monday night, they contemplated the idea of hiring outside legal counsel to put pressure on the Bernero administration and its legal counsel, Dykema Gossett, the firm they used during the McIntyre separation agreement negotiations, to find out what's going on. But you have council members like Patricia Spitzley that publicly have said, you know, I think it's just good money following bad money, and I don't think we should be doing that. So again, another one of those stay tuned things. I'd highly doubt the city is going to get outside legal counsel because the interim city attorney or deputy city attorney advise them Monday night not to do it.
Lansing State Journal reporter Eric Lacey covers city government in Lansing, Lansing City Hall. Eric, thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
And coming up on Current State, the House of Promise is a faith-based nonprofit that provides survivors of sex abuse and sex trafficking unconditional love, acceptance, and a place to heal. For this week's Neighbors in Action, we'll speak with the president and founder of the House of Promise, Sherry Montgomery. That's on the way. Well, after graduating from East Lansing High School back in 1975, Tim Busfield went on to a successful career in the movies, television, and directing. It includes appearances in more than 30 TV movies and feature films, including Revenge of the Nerds as Arnold Poindexter.
Wait. Would you rather live in the ascendancy of a civilization or during its decline?
Oh, a question that was on my mind the moment I woke up this morning. Also, the memorable 1989 fantasy Field of Dreams.
You build a baseball field in the middle of nowhere, and you sit here and you stare at nothing.
Tim Busfield there. Tim has been a regular or recurring character on 14 TV series, including West Wing and 30-something, for which he won an Emmy, and has directed more than 90 television episodes. He's also appeared in over 50 plays. After years living in California, Busfield moved back to Michigan in around 2010. He was joined by his spouse, actress Melissa Gilbert, in 2013. Today, he and Gilbert, who is a Democratic candidate for the 8th Congressional District, live in Brighton. Yesterday, Tim Busfield returned to East Lansing to spend the day here at MSU's College of Communication Arts and Sciences. He spent some time talking with students about the future of storytelling. I first asked him how he feels storytelling is changing.
Well, I mean, when your original storytelling is around the campfire, there was no electronics to it at all. It was just, how did you kill the woolly mammoth, and here's how we did it, and here's how we got the food we're eating. And story evolved in for millennia. We're without any electricity attached to it. And about 100 years ago or so, we started making moving pictures and needing a lot of electricity and a lot of light to make an impression on very slow film. The film, maybe 50 ASA, I don't know if you remember, you're old enough to realize it. Remember that when we had the old Instamatic cameras, and they used to be, it went to 200, and then all of a sudden it went to 400, and we could shoot inside with a new Instamatic. Now that number is about 300,000. On a lot of the computers. They actually shoot better at night than your eye can see. That's how sophisticated they've become. So we've now gone back to the ability to tell stories without needing light, without needing big, huge lights, and then lots of equipment to get rid of the light. Well, now you don't need that. So the ability for a filmmaker to get their stuff out is similar to what you're seeing with the podcast world. So with the new media that we have out there, the desire or need for pushing a boulder uphill to find the equipment necessary to deliver the product is not there anymore.
It's technological, technologically driven change. Is that your focus?
I think that technologically, yes, and how that influences all of the other. You've seen now people with their phones are making YouTube videos, telling shorter stories, finding a way to connect with an audience. And it's not as much a country club environment on who gets there. You used to need to have money or who you knew or how you knew people to get to be able to tell a story. And now you can tell a story on your own and put it up on YouTube and have 10 million people.
But it's affecting some media more than others. I know you've appeared on stage many times, more than 50 times from what I learned. Is storytelling going to change less when it comes to the theater since there's less technology involved?
I think that, to me, that's why I think theater in the round. I think you see theater is dying for a number of reasons. Proscenium theater particularly isn't accessible to the audience anymore because they're used to seeing performances over someone's shoulder, over someone's back. That the distance traveled to a proscenium theater may not necessarily be the best environment for making something feel real. With the ability of putting theater in the round, I think theater adapting to more cinematic values. When you're on somebody's back in a theater situation, you'll still listen. I went down to LCC and saw a play the other night that our stepson is in, and they had the Black Box Theater, which I'd performed in a few years ago, all the way out in a severe thrust. And the director hated it because he had to figure out how to block for that configuration. The audience loved it because they were so intimate. So storytelling has to adjust. And I think that in the future, what we're going to see are storytellers that are delivering docu-fiction feeling stories that the audience feel affected by and that they want to change when they see, which was ultimately the goal of feature films. You know, reality TV has revealed our writing in TV to not be too awfully good.
You've anticipated my next question. I was just going to say, regarding storytelling, how big a factor has reality TV been?
Reality TV's been you can look at it as a negative or you can look at it as a positive. I tend to look at everything as a positive, but you know, the negative aspect of reality TV for what I have been trained to do is I take responsibility, as should everybody in our business, that we were not real enough in our writing or our directing or our acting for the audience to feel like they were to get involved and to get emotionally involved. They find it easier to get emotionally involved with non-scripted emotional storylines that are being improvised, where people and non-actors are expressing their opinions with their own voice. The hardest thing to do for any professional actor and the dividing line between the amateur and the professional is the ability to deliver scripted dialogue believably and with a rhythm which is attractive to the audience. And it's a very difficult thing for actors to do. In reality TV, everybody's using their own dialogue, so everybody sounds more real and the audience tends to believe it more. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be telling fiction narrative stories. We might just need to loosen up our attachment to the dialogue and try to find a more real way and a more effective way of getting that out.
We're talking with actor Tim Busfield, who's spending the day back here at Michigan State in East Lansing. Have you had chances to hear what's on students' minds today? I mean, what's your impression of college-age students, younger people generally, as far as what kind of stories they respond to?
Well, I haven't really talked to them necessarily about what stories they're responding to.
But they're part of this reality TV generation, I guess,
right,
you could
right.
say. So
I think they want it to feel real. I think that for them to relate, they want it to feel real. That world is blown to them. Of just fiction. They're not just going to tune in to an episode of network television that's overwritten and underplayed and accept it. They'd rather click off and go purchase something that moves them off their phone. So they're moving rapidly away from scripted, longer format.
Overwritten and underplayed. That's an interesting combination.
Yeah, it is. It's what a lot of TV is.
Well, underplayed.
You want to underplay overwriting. It's a smart choice. The better actors and what you're going to see, the more professional actors are going to look at an overwritten scene, and they're going to realize the only way to navigate it is to underplay it. You can't play on the writing. If the writing is, I'm very upset and mad and hurt, and I'm crying because you've broke my heart, most actors on TV, you wouldn't be able to squeeze a tear out of them because they're saying how much they feel versus, you know, Denzel Washington and Glory getting whipped and the teardrop falls down his face with no dialogue and he gets an Academy Award and the audience is moved to tears. It's just the climate we're in television, particularly where the development is all about the writing and overwriting. It's the same TV we've had for years. It's just more exposed with reality TV.
I definitely want to talk to you about what you're up to right now. There's a short movie of yours that was shown here at the East Lansing Film Festival last November that is still making the rounds of the festival circuit. It's a movie called One Smart Fellow. You shot this in one day last year? Tell us about
that. Well, we shot it. It was A Saturday night in Wilmington, North Carolina, I was executive producing a show called Secrets and Lies, and I was over at the condo being shared by the director of photography and the camera operator, both friends of mine, and we were sitting around, and I had said that the television, that we are at a turning point, that we do not need this equipment anymore. We have the capabilities of making movies without the studio's involvement, without spending the money. As a matter of fact, we could make a movie right now. I said, next Sunday, we're going to make a movie. We're going to show up here. We're going to make a movie, and I'll show you guys we can make a movie in a day of substance with some weight. And they said, okay, there goes Tim again on his whatever. And throughout the week, I reminded people that we were going to be coming by on Sunday. And around Wednesday or Thursday, I my wife had come back from the Library of Congress where she was being recognized with a couple of books that she'd written. And I said, I committed us to a movie on Sunday. And we improvised a little. And I spent about a half hour and wrote out the story. Had the structure, the three-act structure you often see in most stories, which somebody wants something and they get really far from it, and then their character takes over, a personal character, and we see if they can get what they want or if they should get what they want or don't get what they want. And I applied that structure to that and showed up there around 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning, and by 8 o'clock at night, we'd wrapped. And about a month and a half later, we got an email, and here was this 48-minute movie.
And here you are saying something inappropriate in One Smart Fellow with you and your real-life spouse, Melissa Gilbert, the young actress who plays your daughter.
Everything we do, our whole system is gauged by percentages. You'll see a guy. You'll think, hey, I got a 50% chance of dating that guy. What is the percent chance of getting pregnant?
Sweetie.
What is the percent chance
of...
Dad!
God's name.
What, does it say something gross? I said pregnant, get pregnant, it's gross. The story just came through. It was a really simple story about, you know, of a guy, you know, trying to break up with his wife. And it came out fairly quickly. And I improvised with my wife a little bit. And we kind of found where we were going to go and talked a little bit about our exes and what we might want to bring into it and where we have made mistakes. And the philosophy was, if we show up and you have work on a call sheet, you're going to do the work. And one, two, three, go attitude versus a lot of talking about it and laboring over getting people on board and money and script approval and wardrobe fittings. And we just bypassed all of that, much like Martin Scorsese documentary on George Harrison. And George Harrison is in a makeshift booth that may have been in his home. It looks like they put no money into it. And in the booth is Dylan, Bob Dylan, and he's trying to sing a song. He's struggling. And outside the room is Harrison, Roy Orbison, and Tom Petty. And they're trying to help him figure out a way to record this song. And it's just them. For songs and albums that can make that now with the equipment they have, you can record something at home. Why can't we do that for movies? And why can't we think more like a garage band and throw the ball around? And Keith Richards would say some of the greatest songs that the Stones have written started with a bass line that weren't about writing, that weren't inspired. They just started jamming. So in our world of TV and movies, there's such boulder pushing to get something up. And you have to, it's a miracle to get it on the air. And you have to know people and be in the right place. And nowadays that's over because we have so many streaming services. People can get their work seen and heard elsewhere. Just like radio. Podcasts have become enormously successful. Radio stations are not as necessary because there are other avenues in the new media world to have your own radio show, to mostly talk and listen.
Can people stream One Smart Fellow?
They can't yet. It will be available in July for sale. Right now it's still in the festivals, and then they'll be able to stream it we'll be up on Google and iTunes and Amazon as well as our own streaming platform.
Emmy Award-winning actor, East Lansing native Timothy Busfield there. In part two on Friday, Tim Busfield talks about his years playing in a semi-pro baseball league and its improbable beginning.
And I went out and said, can I throw batting practice? And the coach said, get out of here. And somebody said, no, it's the guy from Field of Dreams. And he goes, hang on a minute. You Field of Dreams? I said, yeah. And he said, you got a cup? And I said, I got a cup. And I came out and I threw some batting practice. He goes, hey, not bad.
Hear that? on Friday here on Current State. Tim Busfield. Coming up today, a team of students at Williamston High School is building an electronic device that helps people with autism or neurological impairments open their lockers. The project is funded through a National Science Innovation Grant that just 14 U.S. high schools received. Nearby Stockbridge received one too, by the way. We'll take a look at Williamston's project handle coming up on Current State. There's a pretty positive vibe to tomorrow night's pop-up stories gathering, too. I'll remind you of this. We get together starting at 6 o'clock at the Eli and Edith Broad Art Museum in East Lansing. Our theme is Lucky Breaks, so we'll be hearing about a lot of people's lucky breaks tomorrow evening between 6 and 7:30. We hope you can join us, okay? 6 to 7:30, the Broad Art Museum in East Lansing, Current State's pop-up stories. I'm Mark Bayshore. Sex trafficking has been a major problem in Michigan, and the recent charges against Stuart Dunnings have brought the issue back into the spotlight once again. Michigan has been ranked fifth in the number of girls being sold into sex slavery, with estimates over 100 girls being lured into the trade per month. Sherry Montgomery, founder of the House of Promise, wants to change that. The House of Promise is a Lansing nonprofit that seeks to be a safe haven for girls ages 12 to 22 who have been victims of trafficking or sexual abuse. Their goal is to disrupt the patterns of slavery through education and care for the survivors. For Neighbors in Action this week, we're finding out more about what they do and how the community can help. Sherry Montgomery joins us now on Current State. Nice to see you again.
Good morning.
How exactly are you able to support victims of trafficking and abuse? Talk to us about what you offer.
Well, we're working on getting the home. That is going to be the key to it. Right now, we're working very diligently to raise funds to purchase a home. But during the time now is we are getting our policies, our procedures, everything that we need to have the house in the background. Every time I come on air somewhere or something, I end up getting girls reaching out to me. And what we do is I do have, you know, a counselor on staff. If I feel that I can help them, I get them in at no charge. And we figure out what we can do. But basically, we need a house to house them because, you know, if you can help them out there only so much because we lose them.
What and why is having a house for these women so important to the mission?
Well, when you're in, I can give you an example of a young lady that called me after one of the talks I did, and she found our number and she called me. She was afraid for her life. She was afraid her pimp was going to kill her. She needed a place now. It took me 2 days calling all over the state, but because she was 18, I could not find a safe place for her. By the time, within 2 days, I lost her. She went back under. So I have no idea where that young lady went.
So shelter is really the heart of your mission and a big part of addressing this problem?
Sure, because, you know, one of my questions is, you know, we had this big raid last year, which is what's linked to, you know, the Stuart Dunning case now and all of that. You know, they rescued these girls that they say that were beaten and drugged. And I don't know if anybody else has asked this question, but what happened to the girls? You know, we have the justice system that is working really hard at getting it right. We have groups, even at Michigan State, that are doing awesome on educating. But there's very few places to put the girls.
What kind of work, what kind of counseling work does your counselor do? What's the heart of that person's treatment for these victims?
Well, we don't have a whole lot right now, you know, so this counselor basically figures out what she needs, how to get her through. You know, one that stayed in counseling the longest was she had been raped at the age of 6, and her perpetrator had, her mother was basically pimping her out. That they went to jail, or the boyfriend went to prison. Mom's still in the picture. She can't get her life together because she's... These girls, when something like that happens, you just don't go into a counseling session or even 2 years of counseling and get it.
No way.
My opinion, and this is just my opinion, these girls need to be taken out of the world for a while. You know, my program's a 2-year program where then we give them the counseling they need, but we give them life skills. We give them other options of what to do other than selling their body, which is the message that they've been told their whole life is that's their worth.
So relearning basic skills is kind of the end game. So they can reintegrate. What kinds of education and training help them reintegrate?
You know, what I believe is you know, basic life skills on I'm going to have business people come in and teach them how to be entrepreneurs, how to handle money, how to have a what you and I would call an adult conversation. Some of these have had such traumatic experiences that even communicating, you know, they're in a fight or flight mode. They're protecting themselves at every step. And so it's getting them to a point where they trust someone enough to open up their heart and learn how to love and trust again.
Understood. Oh, understood. It sounds like just a monumental challenge. Yeah, I'm speaking with Sherry Montgomery, founder and president of the Lansing nonprofit House of Promise. The organization provides counseling, support, training, and education for victims of sex trafficking. But priority one is actually getting their hands on a home for these victims. How do the women you've worked with first become involved in sex trafficking? There must be some kind of pattern here. What is the most common pattern?
There's several, and it's hard to say common because I don't think I've been in it long enough to say all of them. But what I see is mainly starts with broken homes, parents trafficking out their kids, uncle coming into house, raping child, parents aren't paying attention. They get the message that that's their worth. They become promiscuous and end up falling into, you know, the wrong hands. Runaways are huge. Our foster care system, when they age out of foster care, these pimps know it. They're right there, you know, to offer these girls a different life. There's so many ways. There's the ways of being taken, you know, just, you know. But that's probably the least. But we've got a lot of little girls in the state of Michigan that are wanting a better life.
How many victims have passed through the House of Promise at this point?
Well,
you haven't been at this too long.
No, we haven't had the house. So, you know, we've had 4 girls that we've dealt with that have come through our counseling, but they've come and gone because of, you know, we don't have, you know, the home to keep them. They disappear. We get them for
so
a while.
So you're unable to do any follow-up to see whether they're...
No, I just got another girl that's coming in, and we'll see. With her, I think she really just needs to be directed to some agencies, and I think with her, it's just having someone help her walk through because she's gone through such a traumatic instance in her life. This is, you know, one of them that was raped at the age of 6. And she's trying to get through life and she doesn't know how. And so it's getting someone just to direct her into, places where she can get the help.
Is your counselor a volunteer?
No. She does volunteer a lot of time, but, she is a woman that they depend on her salary. And so, you know, I insist on paying her something.
Tell us about your Beauty for Ashes gala coming up next month. This is a way to help.
This is amazing. This is my prayer that this is going to buy us a house. We found the house. We just need the money to buy it. Michigan State University Women's Resource Center have been amazing to the House of Promise. I just can't say enough about them. And they came to me and they said, we want to get you this house. And so they have started a program for the last few months, and they decided to do this gala for us. It's at the Kellogg Center. It's April 21st. It's going to be amazing. It's black tie. You can buy tickets right now online. Just go to thehouseofpromise.com. Make sure you put the in there, thehouseofpromise.com. And there is a tab there for Beauty for Ashes and buy your tickets. So we need you there.
Thehouseofpromise.com. I've been speaking with Sherry Montgomery, founder and president of The House of Promise. The Lansing nonprofit provides counseling, support, training, and education for victims of sex trafficking, but they will improve their service if they find a home. Sherry, thank you for joining us today. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Back in October, we brought you the story of two high schools. Both are in Ingham County. Both are National Science Award winners. Stockbridge High School and Williamston High School each received a grant from the Lemelson MIT program that's awarded to teams that invent a product that serves some tangible, beneficial purpose. Stockbridge and Williamston were among just 14 schools in America to receive the award. Now tonight, Williamston High School students will invite the public to take a look at their project. Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me now with more. What are they working on, Kevin?
Mark, it's called HANDLE, and that's an acronym that stands for Helping the Autistic and Neurodevelopmentally Disabled with Lockers. It's a small motorized device that you attach to a combination lock on a school locker. It turns the dial, and bingo, your locker is open. There are several students involved in this project, and you'll hear from a few of them in a moment. First, though, I talked with Emma Drake, who is on the public relations side of the HANDLE project.
This is a device that we are hoping that students with disabilities would be able to carry around, and it goes directly onto a combination locker dial, and the combination would be programmed into the device so they could just place it on, and it would open the locker for a student that would otherwise be unable to access their locker.
Somebody who doesn't really have good manual dexterity in their fingers for whatever reason.
Absolutely. So we are focusing specifically on fine motor skill disabilities or cognitive disabilities. So whether they were physically unable to open their locker or if it was a problem with remembering the combination or understanding how to input it.
Emma, at what point did you and your team members first think of this idea, and how did you get the attention of the Lemelson MIT program?
So we knew that we wanted to apply for a Lemelson MIT Invent Team grant, and so we wanted to find something, a problem, especially in our own community. So there's a program at our school called Peer-to-Peer, which is where we learn about disabilities and interact with students in our basic skills classroom. So my teammate Anna Bowling and I went to a peer-to-peer meeting, and we learned about a specific challenge, which is opening school lockers.
What have some of your classmates who have these disabilities told you about how it is trying to get along in everyday life? Have they ever really expressed their frustrations to you about that? And what do they think of this project?
Well, I work with some of these students every day in a program called Links, which comes off of peer-to-peer. But while they might not have directly expressed their frustrations, you can tell. But the number one thing that anyone will tell you, special ed teachers or anyone that works with students, is they want to fit in. And I would say that's probably the number one reason why we would like to do this, is we think that being able to just hang out at your locker, use your locker, it's something that a lot of high school students take for granted, and we want to extend that opportunity to students that don't have it now.
I'm John Hall. So basically what we have in here so far is we have a motor, and then we have a little thing on the top with the laser mount. So that laser, it will reflect off of the locker, and we put a little reflective strip right on zero so that the laser will reflect off of the right off of the reflective strip, and then it'll bounce back. The laser doesn't know initially where zero is to start off with. So this laser strip will help it find where zero is, and then it'll know to turn to there, and then it will start with the combination.
Okay, and I was watching as you were testing it just now. You guys have, protruding out of the plastic housing, a rotating circular clamp, for lack of a better word. That's what actually goes onto the dial portion of the locker. How does that work in tandem with the laser? And I'm going to pick on you, young man here in the sweater. And what is your name?
Justin Kreese. It's a part that we 3D printed, and it actually took us several times to get it 3D printed to where it would fit over the dial perfectly. And we used the new printer that we got this year, which is a Very nice printer, makes very high quality parts, and we were able to use that to make something that would fit over the dial pretty well. And then we found that dipping it in Plasti-Dip, which is this stuff that you'd use to coat like handles of tools and different things, it's a rubbery coating. We put that on the inside, and we found out that that helps it grip onto the dial a lot better. So that's how we turn the combination on the locker.
But how does it understand how far to turn left or right to get to the right combination?
When the laser reflects off of the reflective tape, it hits the sensor that's on the front of the device, and the program interprets this increase in light, and that's how it knows where zero is. And then the program, which has the combination entered into it, knows the position of the dial and then turns it in the different directions after it figures out where initially it is and lines itself up with zero. It's not gonna work that time. Okay.
So it's very touchy. You have to have it positioned just right, and I think I heard it slipping a little bit. So it's gotta be really pretty precisely locked onto the dial.
Yeah, and one of the issues is also the part that goes over the dial has to be perfectly centered on the shaft of the motor. Otherwise, the front of it's going to kind of move around in a circle, and then the whole device kind of sways around. So you have to hold it very gently so you don't bind it all together, and we're still working on getting everything lined up perfectly so that you can just hold it straight on there.
So admittedly, Justin, still some bugs to work out, but you're getting close.
Yeah, definitely. We have a lot of things that we hope to accomplish before we go to Eureka Fest, but we're gradually making progress, and I know that we're going to have a pretty good working prototype by the time it's ready for us to showcase our invention at Eureka Fest.
Joe Rasmus, Williamson High School math teacher and event team advisor.
There is something now called a mid-grant technical review that the Lemelson MIT program requires. What does that really mean?
It's basically a public presentation where we invite stakeholders and community members, family members, to come out, see what we've done. We kind of have a formal presentation. We have some tables and stations where they walk around and see different aspects of the project. And then we solicit feedback. We have feedback forms that we give them to have them say what they like, what they think could be adjusted, that kind of thing. By stakeholders, we mean like people that work in special education or are special ed professors or researchers at Michigan State, or work in organizations like START through Grand Valley or the Mid-Michigan Autism Association.
People who would be direct beneficiaries of this, not a financial stakeholder, that's what Lemelson MIT does as the grantor.
Correct.
But obviously, these beneficiaries, these stakeholders, want to see a return on their investment. So they're going to want to see a viable product working pretty soon, opening up lockers.
That's the goal. And hopefully we show them something that shows them we're making some good progress. We're going to admit that it's not a finished product yet. But we still have a few months to work out those bugs. And hopefully they can give us some ideas, too, on some things that in those last few months that we might want to tweak that maybe we haven't thought of.
So at this point, it's about progress, not necessarily about perfection.
Exactly.
I'm going to ask these guys one more quick question, okay? What excites you about this project? Not everybody leaps out of bed to go to school, but I think I would if I were working on this.
I think the most exciting part of this project is really the design and development process of the device and watching it actually work and having those exciting moments when it finally works after however many hours of working on it and endless, downfalls and having to change things. And then obviously the most important part of this project is helping other people. So helping those kids that have the fine motor problems is obviously the end goal of this project, and that's what we're really looking forward to even more than Eureka Fest.
John, any thoughts?
Yeah, it's just really excited, to help others too, and we're also really excited to travel out to Eureka Fest in the summer. I'll go visit Boston and MIT. We're already starting to get some events planned out, so we're pretty excited about that.
Justin?
Well, it's very exciting because this is a very technical solution to the problem that there's a lot of things that we have to work on, and every day it's very exciting to improve it, and there's always something that we all have in mind that we need to get done, so it's just good to watch the progress happen and move forward with the device.
Justin Kreese, John Hall, and Robert Cheney are part of the Williamson High School Invent Team, and they're having their mid-grant technical review where the public gets to see their device nicknamed Handle, which helps people open up lockers. Guys, thank you. Great work. This looks exciting. Keep at it.
All right. Thank you very
much. Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And that's our show for today. The Michigan State Senate yesterday passed a $715 million bailout for the troubled Detroit public schools. The bill now heads to the House as lawmakers stare down an April 8th deadline to keep the schools open. Tomorrow on Current State, we talk to Skillman Foundation CEO Tanya Allen and Detroit education activist. Also, MSU Assistant Professor Sarah Reckow about what lies ahead for education in Detroit. Plus, some MSU students are thinking big and building small with the campus's first tiny house. We talked to Tiffany Pupa about the Sparty's Cabin being built inside the MSU Surplus Center. That and more Thursday on Current State. Don't forget, Thursday evening at the Broad, it's pop-up stories. Stories about having a lucky break. We'll have light refreshments and a fantastic lineup of storytellers. We hope to see you there. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. April Van Buren directed the program today. Thanks as well to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. Don't forget the Current State podcast. Get to it. Get it sent straight to your smartphone every day via iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. We'll be looking for you Thursday on Current State.